Makalani Bendele is today's featured author on New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where writers and authors of African American life, arts, culture, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and we'll be discussing Makalani Bendele's new collection of poetry, Hail Fightin', published by Willow Books in 2012. Readers have noted that Hail Fightin' is filled with music. It draws on the African-American jazz aesthetic and the blues tradition. Makalani talks a lot about his cultural influences in the book and how he's come to write poetry. Let's listen in. Hello, Mak.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm very well. Thanks for asking.
Good, good.
Widely anthologized in notable literary journals such as Southwestern, Mythium, the Tidal Basin Review, Hail Fightin', the book that we're discussing today by Makalani Bendele, is his first full-length volume of poetry, and it's a wonderful one, too. Mak, for short, is an Afro-Latin poet, which means he's dedicated to highlighting the Black influence and cultural history in the Appalachian region in his work. And you see that in his use of the regional vernacular and such terms as the Kentucky oyster, referring to chitlins. But what's really wonderful is how he employs what some have called the jazz aesthetic, applying the features of the African-American musical genre to language performance. In this vein, you'll find scatting, ba-da-da-da-da, in several of his poems, as in the poem In the Key of Democracy. This collection of poems is a delight to read, and I'm happy to have Mak on the show today to discuss it with us. Mak, will you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and maybe a little bit about your name?
Well, I am born in Cincinnati, well, Hamilton County, Ohio, just outside of Cincinnati. And after a year of moved to Louisville, Kentucky. I was an orphan and was adopted in Louisville, Kentucky. And from that point, basically born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. I went to a local prep high school here, St. Xavier, there's a St. X in Cincinnati too, St. Xavier in Cincinnati too. But I went to the one here in Louisville. My last year in high school went to Germany as an exchange student with the Congress Bundestag scholarship. So that's my first experience with international travel and living internationally. Then I moved back here and went to University of Notre Dame undergrad. And that's where I first got exposed to poetry. My first teacher, John Mathias, took a couple of classes with him, and John is known as a scholar and completely enclosed and understands British and American modernism, and his influence can be seen greatly in my poetry if you look close enough. I'm very image based. Poetry. And then from there, actually took a detour. I left poetry for about 11 years. Was called into the ministry and was a pastor for 11 years. So I had a very long journey. After I left pastoring, after sabbatical, went back to writing and reading poetry. Didn't write much while I was preaching and pastoring. And I've come back full circle. After the sabbatical, when I was writing, I decided, you know, maybe I want to leave this ministry thing for a while and pick writing back up. And so that's what phase I am in now. I've been back at writing full time for about 4 years.
So. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to ask you this question because one of my favorite writers who is James Baldwin was influenced heavily by the church and was a youth preacher. And he said that even though he left the pulpit, that that church influence is ever present in his writing. And as a matter of fact, the writing itself is a way of preaching. Is there an influence in your writing?
Completely. My experience in the church has had a tremendous impact on helping me to understand the souls of Black folk, to coin the phrase from W.D. Du Bois's seminal text. It's amazing how much, at being an adult and really being able to savor the cultural art of Black people, I think that what's left of Black folk, what goes on in the church is definitely on the sacred level, but also as the secular and the sacred bleed together in the African American community. The art of Black people is so clearly seen in the church. I mean, the song, the vocal quality, the storytelling and the preaching and in the conversations on the church step, after service on Sunday or at a church picnic, while next to the lemonade stand. That art of what Black folk, their speech, their music, the instrumentation in the church, it's there. And for me, when I was a preacher, some of it was just kind of by way of osmosis. It was just going in and it comes out in the poetry. But some of it, I really looked at it and studied it closely, and in terms of trying to understand the storytelling art as preachers, trying to understand the vocal art of delivering a sermon. Looking at these as really cultural arts and as crafts that it takes time and mentorship and it takes training to be able to do these things well. So yes, without a doubt, so much of my poetry is informed by what I learned in the church. And it's not just content, it's style, it's the approach to, you know, to the poetry and thinking of it as that I am an apprentice, that I am at some point maybe a journeyman, that I am at some point, you know, a little bit more adapted or more capable in the craft.
Wow, nice. And you have a very interesting and attractive name, Makalani Bendele. Does it mean anything?
Yes. Makalani is from the eastern coast of Africa, Tanzania, Kenya area, those coastal areas. The Mawira is the tribe, and it means one who is gifted in writing. And then Bendele, or Bandele, is a Yoruba term, which means born away from home. So, you know, as I said, I was orphaned, I was adopted when I was a year old. And so that sense of born away from home, but also the double meaning of being African American, you know, where is our home? And the sense that, you know, being born here, we're born away from home. So it was a name that, when I was in, graduated from college, I came home. And, you know, had been influenced at university by Afrocentrism at the time, and really studied a lot of African culture and African philosophy. And came home and wanted to change my name. And my mother was like, "Oh no, not you! You got a good name. My name is Michael Pinden by birth." So that has its poetic undertones too, or overtones too. We sat down, she eventually conceded, and we sat down, and she helped me pick a name. So that's how it came about.
Now let's launch into the discussion of your wonderful poetry. You begin with a very a hybrid introduction, I call it, Ars mm-hmm. Poetica Jazz, an introduction. And I remember in school reading a poem called Ars Poetica, I think, by Archibald MacLeish.
Incredible poem.
And so
my favorite.
It seems that you draw from a traditional poetic poetic forms, as well as mixing in the improvisatory nature of of jazz music and the blues. Can you tell us about this introduction and what you're trying to do for the reader?
You're spot on, Vershawn. As a poet, I see myself in dialogue with the poets and poetry that is going on right now and that has come before me. And I see myself a part of a huge multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multicultural community. That poem that you gave reference to, Archibald MacLeish's Ars Poetica. In fact, in writing an Ars Poetica jazz, I looked, lots of different poets' Ars Poetica, and Ars Poetica means the art of poetry. So, a poem can be Ars Poetica without being called Ars Poetica. It's basically when a poet talks about what they're trying to do, or what a poem should try to do, or what a poem is doing, or how it should be read, or the poem reading us. So any of these kind of notions or suggestions about craft, or how to approach craft, or how to approach a line or metaphor or whatever, is ars poetic. So in this first poem, I'm setting out kind of what was the approach that I took in trying to write these poems. And I was trying to say I'm moving away from a jazz poetry that I feel like is most associated, or poetry that's most associated with jazz. And that is just kind of a dropping name of I've had an experience, or I listened to this record, or I went to see this particular jazz artist, and this is what happened there, and this is how it made me feel, and this is what it sounds like, or whatever. And I tried to move away from that and try to say that I'm looking at some of the deep structures of jazz, how it works, and I'm trying to put that onto a page. So as a jazz artist would improvise, I'm trying to, in creating a line, I'm trying to do the same thing. I'm trying to kind of stay in the moment, and even though it's going to get edited around at the end, in the first writing of it, the thoughts move almost like the thoughts of Sonny Rollins soloing, like the way his lines follow one another, the logic behind that. That's the kind of logic I tried to put into create, into writing lines in a poem. And then the stories that are told, particularly in the blues, it's clear. It's also in the music of jazz, but it's notes, so it's hard to translate. But in blues, you see the storytelling that is very disjunctured. That is, at one point he's saying that hot foot powder has been sprinkled on his door. Then the next line he's talking about, he's talking about laying in bed with the chills. And then the next line he's talking about he's on the steamship going down the river. And it's like, how does he jump in one section of the song, the first, AAB section, how does he jump from that, where he's talking about hot foot powder, and all of a sudden get to being on a boat? But if you know the blues and you kind of understand the cultural context of it, you say, well, it's simple. I mean, he's running away from his baby. She tried to put a hex on him. So now he's out of town. So, and that's what happens in the poems. I try to do kind of the same thing. I'm not worried about saying ABC, but in a narrative way that you understand things happen because of A. You understand the story. I'm not, I don't mind, I don't care to jump and to take leaps and leave parts of the story out.
What I really appreciated also about this introduction is the way in which you not only perform what's to come in the later poems, but also give us clues about the kind of structure that you'll use. I picked out some of the formal terms that you use, the caesura, the quartet, the sestina. And these are all poetic strategies and techniques that you use throughout your book. Is that true?
Oh, definitely, definitely, definitely. That particular line that you referenced, if I can just read a couple of lines before and kind of put it in the context. A call to be the inversion of Ellington, distillation of the Hellfighters, down to quartet, no more than sustain. Charlie Ralph is an apostrophe on sax, cutting invisible cats so clean they're seen Lindy hopping with a grin from ear to ear. So as an ars poetica poem, I'm suggesting that in those particular lines that there was a certain my muse and this call, that call, there's that preacher in me, that call to be the inversion of Ellington. So you have Ellington, who's this incredible composer, maybe some people have said the greatest American composer of the 20th century, and definitely the most prolific. And so he's writing these incredible jazz symphonies, and the poem as an inversion of that, it's brought back down to that. The distillation of the Hellfighters, and the Hellfighters band is what I'm referencing there. The Harlem Hellfighters band, led by James Reach Europe, bring jazz to Europe in World War I. They had never heard this ragging, the way that they syncopated the drums and the horns, and they played the Les Marseillaises in France, the French anthem. They played it, and the French didn't even recognize it because they had, quote unquote, jazzed it up so much. And when they began to recognize the Les Marseillaises, French people, they said they did movements that they didn't know their bodies could do. It just ejaculated out of them because they were so brilliant and so excited to hear this sound and recognize it and be also new at the same time and danceable and plotting, rhythmic. So that the poem breaks or distills down to that, and then no more than a quartet. I mean, down to a quartet, no more than a sustain. And at the same time, I'm also kind of talking about Thelonious Monk and as him being an influence in kind of how I approach much of the poem, trying to think like Monk in terms of feeling free to be influenced by the classical music, feeling free to be influenced by church music, feeling free to be influenced by jazz, feeling free to be influenced by R&B. That's what I feel Monk was. He just brought it all to the piano and didn't feel like he had to, he didn't feel guilty about, loving Rachmaninoff and knowing by memory whole slabs of a work of Rachmaninoff. And he wasn't afraid to bring that nuance to the piano when he played jazz. And so I wanted to say the same thing in poetry. I don't feel that I have to alienate all of these influences that I have. They can all come through. In fact, that's when the poem is the best, when anything is allowed to come through, and it comes through, and I, and it comes together as only it can in my voice, because I'm the experienced one that puts all those experiences together.
And not to linger too long on this opening poem, I want to get to some of the others, but you do end this introductory poem with a strong vernacular invitation. You tell the reader, "Come," towards a poetic of putting pennies together and stepping out. Saturday Night, Barrel House Arrangement of Troubles on Page in Ways That Bespeaks Buoyancy and Points to Brighter Embouchure. Now, I was struck by this last line or last phrase that points to brighter embouchure. Now, well, I know it's probably double entendre and probably multiple meanings here, but the embouchure, of course, is referencing the facial structure, right, of a trumpeter or a horn player, and also maybe there's this invocation here that by reading this poetry and being engaged in it, that we would be able to speak a new language or be inspired to speak. That's what I got from it.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's the embouchure is how a musician that plays a reed instrument has to hold their mouth or has to hold their lips. I mean, embouchure is important, of course, for the clarinet. It may be in some ways most crucial, maybe for the trumpet, or it's most known for the trumpet. That's it. I mean, that of course the porter is always pointing toward, you know, the music or the voice. And so, of course, I'm pointing toward that. I'm saying that this poetic is maybe a brighter or newer version of how to hold one's mouth so that the words come out artistic or they come out.
Wow. Thank you for that. What's your favorite poem in the collection?
That's tough. I feel like because there are some very formal poems, they're formal, but they are definitely variations on the theme. They don't necessarily follow the form exactly precise. There are triolets, there are sonnets in this, there are pantoons. So there's lots of different forms in the book. So and then poems kind of take different approaches. There are, like I said, there are poems that are blues. I mean, it's a strict blues. There's the AAB form in the poem. Then there are poems that are, like I said, where I try to think of how Sonny Rollins or how Thelonious Monk or how Chick Corea is what the mind is doing, what the musical mind is doing as it's putting this note with this chord. Why did he move from this tonality to a different? Why did the time, how did he speed up? What made him do that? I tried to approach a poem in the same way. Okay, I can't change notes, but what can I change? Can I change the tone of the poem? In the next line, can I so completely, deviate from what the first line was about? In this line, can I move from this idea to the next by just taking one little word or one connotation or denotation that that word in the first line has and pick that up in the second line? It's not going to be something that people notice unless they're paying attention to the denotation of all the words in the first line where they speak. That's why you went to this next line. Otherwise, ostentatiously, the two lines have no connection to each other. But they do. There is a logic. And that's what I was trying to work with, sometimes. Like, that's what the jazz artist is doing, instantaneously is he's improvising. That's how he gets from the one line to the next. So, yeah. So, but I to say that which poems are my favorite, it changes from day to day. I mean, there's different things that I like on a particular day, and I approach that poem and say, man, I think I captured that. I captured that technique, or that tool that I use, that poetic tool that I use. I really think I did it good or did an excellent job of that in this particular poem. So it's hard. It's very hard to pick a favorite one.
One of the blurbists, Mitchell L.H. Douglas, writes about your use of government and improvisation when he says, when Bendele declares, I like my government like I like my improvisation, mellifluous, we can't help but think government could easily be exchanged for poetry, turning the line into a take on Bendele's skill, secular, sacred, and singing loud. And he says that hell fight inspires. Now, that line that he references is taken from your poem, Jazz in the Key of Democracy in Three Movements, for Cornel West.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is this poem? What's the poem about?
Well, the poem is about, in writing the book, I had to do an incredible amount of research on jazz. So I read a lot of criticism, of jazz albums that came out, contemporary on back. I read a lot of intro to jazz books. I read books with essays by literary critics on jazz. Read books of anthologies of jazz poetry, jazz short story. So I tried to look at how jazz has been approached as a subject in literature, how jazz has been criticized or evaluated in literature. And I looked at, writers who tried to write in a quote-unquote jazz aesthetic. One of the ones that I continue to come back to was Ralph Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
Just an incredible literary critic and scholar, and knows jazz probably just as good as anybody that I read. And one of the things that he influences Stanley Crouch. And then Stanley Crouch influences Wynton Marsalis. And Wynton Marsalis is he right now is the mouthpiece for jazz. He's not just in terms of his music, but in terms of his philosophy. He is the intellectual that we turn to when we want to talk about jazz as an art form. Anyway, there's this notion that I think that Ellison implies, and that it grows through Crouch and through Wynton Marsalis, that jazz is democratic. That if you want to look at something that's uniquely American, and that's what that's another thing that Ellison and his acolytes espouse is this fact that jazz is the only truly American art form, or one of the only truly American art forms. It has its birth here in America, and gone worldwide and influenced worldwide.
Let me ask you this question. Let me interject a second and ask you, why for Cornel West, though?
Oh, because Cornel West, he has an interview where he talks about jazz as a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
This whole notion of jazz being a democracy, that the players get together and they have to work out, musically what they're going to do, who comes in when, how long they come in. It's a conversation. The saxophone in his solo, he needs the bass, to be where it's supposed to be in each measure for him to be able to solo and to expand and to go out into space and then come back and know that there's some place to come back to. If the bass, gets lost in the saxophone solo and he gets out of measure and out of time, then when the saxophone comes back, it's going to sound like, people banging pans together and people whistling, with no concern for each other.
Mm-hmm.
It will be haphazard. So there's this communication that goes on. So Cornel West talks about it specifically in an interview, but Stanley Crouch speaks of jazz being democratic, and Marcel spoke of jazz being democratic. And I first saw Ralph Ellison, the first person to kind of mention this sense that jazz is democratic. So I left it to Cornel West because I wanted to, in some sense, give reference to an actual article that he has called Jazz as a Democracy, or something to that effect. No one else gets it that clearly. You hear Crouch mention it in an essay, but his whole essay isn't jazz is a democracy. Whereas Cornel West has this interview where the whole thing he's expanding on that notion.
And you end this poem with a scat. Could you render that for us?
Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
it's kind of an improvisation off of at its very core, people will hear Thelonious Monk's Epistrophe, the melody or the head to Thelonious Monk's Epistrophe. But I kind of switched it just a little bit. There is a little bit of Makalani nuance to it, but at its fundamental core, it would be a sonic rendering of Thelonious Monk's Epistrophe.
Now, let me ask you this about getting the most out of the reading of the poetry here. Should I or would you recommend me as a reader listening to some of the jazz artists that you draw from, Thelonious Monk, Coltrane, etc., so I can get a fuller sense of what's going on in the rhythmic features of the poetry? Or can I approach it cold and still be just as informed, and the reading experience be just as rewarding?
I would like to think that you could come to it. I would not have done my job if a reader can't come to this not knowing much about jazz and not get a lot out of the poems. I would hope that for example, in that poem, Jazz in the Key of Democracy for Cornel West, I really feel like there's a musicality in just the way that certain lines are rendered in the poem, and I feel like it comes across no matter, you know, if you're reading it out loud or if you're just reading it to yourself. To me, there's a certain musicality. We, the hip people, avoid exploiting anybody or anything. Propose finest of arts, ensemble. I mean, to me, I'm biased, but to me as a reader, I think, you know, that no matter how you read that, if you look at the punctuation, if you look at the line break and you read it, you will see a certain rhythmic quality that you won't see in other poems that you might read.
Mm-hmm.
It's lyrical. It's not trying so much to convey that this happened and then this happened. I went to the store. It's not telling so much as it is kind of waxing or lyricizing. So I would hope that it would be musical, whether a person knew anything about jazz or not.
It's very musical. It's extremely musical. But your rendering of that ending was awesome, I should say. And so I felt just a little embarrassed in my reading. I think I probably skipped over some of the more musical. I didn't linger as well as I should say, in my first reading. So it makes me want to go back. But I want to imagine for a moment that you are a jazz artist. And I'm at the club and I'm making a request for a performance. Mm-hmm. And the performance that I want to hear is out of the mouthpiece of an evolving consciousness. And the reason why I want to hear this one is because it is so lyrical and so musical that I'd like to hear the artist's render it for us, or maybe just a portion of it, if you might.
You picked a poem that of when you said that about it, kind of reading over part. Some of the I think it's like six or seven poems that have out of the whole collection that have sonic in them, that have these like added terms, and. And I, I didn't want all the folks to have that by any stretch of the imagination. I wanted to kind of give people the ability to read over this such that it wasn't that integral. But you picked a poem that it is integral to. You can't skip it in this poem. It's embedded in the poem. But I had hoped that it was so obvious, especially if you're somewhat familiar with Coltrane, that you would get the sound. So you want me to read a little bit of Out of the Mouthpiece?
If you would.
Okay. So, Out of the Mouthpiece of an Involving Consciousness. Ba da ba do ba da da. Ba da ba do ba, blue train. Ba da ba do ba da da. Off the beaten path, a flat minor, yet on track, black was always on his way out of the earth's gravitational pull. Ba da ba do ba, coal train. Murdered the popular song. He do 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 down, under, through, home with him, apart in our very ears, trying to get something off, ba-da-ba-do-ba, trying to get something up.
Wow, very nice. Now, I have to ask you this question. As a poet, and as a poet who performs, what's your recommendation for consumers, the public, in buying, reading, and going to listen to poetry?
Well, so often I hear poets bemoaning how terrible, how boring, you know, how almost unbearable poetry readings are. And I can't say I quite agree, especially as I've grown as a poet and my understanding. But at some level, poetry readings are very much insulated. They're very much insulated, and there's the kind of in-the-know group of people, and if you're not in the know, then you're not going to kind of get what's going on. And I hate that about poetry, and I don't, you know, I want to stay in the conversation with poets. I want to be, you know, I want to be in dialogue with Wallace Stevens. I want to continue this conversation with Ed Roberson, who's a living poet. I want to continue, you know, the conversations that I've been having with Theodore Retke. I want to continue to have these conversations with these poets, but I don't want to insulate myself so much that when I read in public, people don't get something out of it. To the reading public, you know, my only thing is that it has to listen closely to the words. And a lot of the very contemporary poetry, not a lot of sense per se is trying to be made. What they're trying to do is they're going after a tone. A lot of poets are going after a particular tone. They want you to feel something more so than actually maybe being able to put, you know, some kind of syllogistic logic together to understand the poem. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are just lost. They don't understand why the poet was talking about, you know, a dead bird on the sidewalk, and then the next thing the poet is talking about eating a bowl of cold spaghetti. You know, why this jump? But you had to kind of listen to every word and kind of follow the flow that the poet is going in to get that subtle play or that subtle tampering that poet is trying to do with your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're an Afro-Latin poet. Can you talk to us about what that means exactly and how that comes through in this book?
Well, an Appalachian poet. It's a group. I'm a member of a group of poets, and Appalachia is a region that I think people forget runs from northern New Hampshire all the way down to northern Alabama. So, as Appalachia, the region of Appalachia runs that long course. Any person of color living in that region, we would, as Appalachian poets, we would say they're Appalachian. And then we also include what would be metropolis or urban areas that people from Appalachia migrate to. So if people in Appalachia would migrate to Charlotte, North Carolina, they would immigrate to Raleigh. People in like in around the Tennessee area, Nashville, Knoxville, Louisville, which is where I'm from. These are metropolitan areas, urban areas where, you know, the economy in Appalachia is so immature. It's been just relied on coal, and that there's not a lot of opportunity for people. People leave that area and they go into these urban areas, and the strong Appalachian culture ends up influencing these areas. So I see myself as an Appalachian in that I am an African American that lives in a community and was born and raised and got my entire foundation in a city that has been heavily influenced by African Americans who come out of the Appalachian region and have brought that culture with them. And my father is from Danville, and my mother Kentucky, and my mother is from Springfield, Kentucky. So they're country folk from southeastern kind of Kentucky, just on kind of the foothills. They're people that have people that come out of the mountains of Kentucky. So that anything that comes out of my poetry to some extent is an example of my Appalachian influence. I mean, when you would think that people like Nina Simone is technically Appalachian by that definition, when you would consider that August Wilson is Appalachian. I see myself as Appalachian, not necessarily because I'm always talking about the mountains, but that I'm talking about moonshine. These are things that are stereotypes we need to get away from anyway. But I see myself as Appalachian because I understand the full cultural contribution of that area to the whole Eastern Seaboard.
And how does that come through here? Is there any particular poems that that really show more than another or than others this this Afro-Latin identity?
The first poem, as you pointed out, it has some clear references. The 32 bar jar of the jambinest blackberry boogie that you could cook up so folks would want to come inside. The whole notion of canning, that's just country people in general. But I mean, it's still because of the economics in Appalachia and because of its isolation, it is a few years back. It's something that still is not something that city folk do now to kind of like reach back to the rustic. It's still something that is done. And then it's the Kentucky oyster simmering, Lord have mercy, mama, stinking up the whole damn house. That's Southern. But when you talk about the Southeast, you can't talk about the Southeast without talking about Appalachia and the influence of that region's culture on black people.
Now, in a moment, I'm going to allow you to end our interview with a reading of some of your poems or a poem, whichever you choose. But I have a couple more questions I want to ask you first. And one of them is about the structure of the book. Now, this interview will be cross-posted on New Books in Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But as this interview is mainly on New Books in African American Studies, and some mm-hmm. of the listeners may not be as familiar with some of the terminology and some of the features, I want to ask you about the pronunciation of some of the terms that you use. And I want to point out before I do that, that in the back of the book, there's a wonderful glossary that mm-hmm. you have created that gives insight into some of the terms that you use in the poems and some of the musical references that you make. And I think that it really makes a difference for a novice poetry reader, or even someone who's not really familiar with some of the formal features of poetry, to take a look at that glossary, perhaps first, and to read the poems. But you intersperse these poems with shorter poems, and I know that I'm going to mispronounce this term. I'm not even going to try it. Yes. Thank you. One more time. Pronounce it one more time.
A cacciatura.
A cacciatura.
Cacciatura. Okay. I may be mispronouncing too. It's Italian. Music, for the most part, most musical terms have their root in Italian.
Okay.
So it's an Italian term, and it means a grace note. So it's a note that allows you, it's a little soft, not necessarily soft, but a simple little note that will get you from one note to another. Sometimes to some extent, almost like modulating if it's in a higher key, but not so much. This is really something used primarily in improvisation. It kind of gets you from one note to another. And that in the book, the cacciatura, these grace notes, their grace notes are never, they're not on the music sheet. They're not on the sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't show up, but it's there. Everyone knows that it's there in the song or in the composition. Everyone knows it's there, but it's not on the sheet music. It's just to get you from one note to the next. And that's in the book, they don't have a page number, the cacciatura. They're little haiku, or what I would call jazz coup. They capture either sonically an image or visually an image of a moment in jazz.
Very nice.
Whether it be at a club or whether it be on a particular album.
Now, tell us what you're working on now.
I am, before I started the book Hell Fighting, it started out as a chapter, about half of these poems. And they just coalesced over the years, over a period of about a couple of years, they coalesced all these jazz poems. And I didn't really have any idea of doing anything with them, but I submitted them as a chapter, and then the publisher, we would prefer actually to just do it as a full length, if you can do a whole project. And the chapbook is cool, but we'd like to see a larger volume, more poems. So I went back and did that. Before I was doing that, I was on working on a project where I was listening to the recordings of Alan Lomax. Alan Lomax is one of probably the most important audio recorder. He went back into the South and really all over the world trying to almost save folk music. He saw what the radio and popular culture, this coalescing of popular culture, was doing to the folk art. So he tried to go out and try to save the folk arts and folk music. And so a lot of the early recordings that we have of of field hollers, a lot of work songs. Him and his father, John Lomax, they recorded them. So I was listening to these recordings and, you know, reading the biographies of Lomax, both Lomaxes, and reading interviews with him and trying to write poems in that reflect or somehow meditate on the music, the culture that they had captured in these recordings and in the books that they're writing and in their travels trying to get these recordings. So I'm going to go back to that. But at the same time, I'm being drawn to some subjects around Kentucky. And so I'm kind of working on two projects at the same time, trying to come up with some very regional Kentucky Louisville poems out of my experience growing up here and out of the contemporary scene that I see here. And then I'm also trying to come back to this work that I was doing before, Hell Fighting. And I'm really such a different poet that I'm having to kind of rethink these poems and try to understand how I'm going to come at the project. Because I don't want to definitely come the way I was before I started Hell Fighting. Hell Fighting has changed me too much to come back the same.
And can you take us out with the reading?
Okay. I think what I'll do is just take us out with the last poem in the book. It's called Coda. Inhale tomorrows, all the dreams they contain, and fair view of end. The changes blow everybody away, a lift, hucklebuck, to which Parker replied, which is to say, leap, a half step up, an octave, every line, a poem, every poem, a journey, a juke. Now's the time to change addresses. I told the family, let me have a minute alone with Mac. Close the door behind you, lips taste of ear, even as if asleep. I know music moves the dreamer, guilt the anchor, ship is sinking. Passengers and crew are safe in life, boats. Save your fare, captain. The sea is soft and blue. As absolution, lush as coda, then the slow white drift, but the body remains heavy with itself as a bough with leaves and white blossoms. A few petals collect quietly on the ground beneath trees lost, lush as life.
Makalani Bendele is the author of Hell Fightin', published by Willow Books this year in 2011. Thank you, Mak, for talking with us on New Books in African American Studies.
Thank you so much, Dr. Young. Thank you.
We've been discussing Makalani Bendele's debut collection of poetry, Hell Fightin', published by Willow Books in 2012. As you can see from our lively exchange, Makalani is not only a poet, he's a cultural archivist, a musical historian, and an astute cultural critic. If you haven't already picked up your copy of Hell Fightin', go out and do it today. Share this interview and Makalani's book with all your friends.